informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it plans to stop taking voluntary measures that give the agency broader access under the so-called Additional Protocol. Iran has been implementing the Additional Protocol voluntarily as part of its commitments under the nuclear deal with world powers, known as the JCPOA.
I have delivered a letter from the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Director General of the IAEA, specifying that as of 23rd February 2021, Iran will stop all voluntary measures beyond its safeguard commitments as envisaged in the JCPOA.
Kazem Gharibabadi said as of February 23rd, cooperation between Iran and the IAEA would be based solely on the country's safeguards agreement with the agency. If U.S. sanctions are effectively lifted, he added, Iran would resume implementation of all voluntary measures. The decision is in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament almost 2 months ago, obliging the government to reduce IAEA access and step up nuclear enrichment if U.S. sanctions are not lifted, specifically those imposed against Iranian oil exports and the country's banking system. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions as part of a maximum pressure policy after withdrawing from the nuclear deal in 2018. Meanwhile, Iran has also informed the IAEA of its serious concerns over the protection of confidential information. In an official letter, Iran has asked the agency to revise its policies in order to avoid the far too common instances of IAEA reports being leaked to the media via unauthorized access, potentially threatening the country's national security. Since it was implemented in 2016, the nuclear deal has given the IAEA unprecedented access to Iranian nuclear sites. But that level of cooperation would inevitably come to an end if efforts to revive the JCPOA fail. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Ex-President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his second impeachment trial, finally closing the curtain on the nation's bitterly disputed election last November. Trump was accused of incitement to insurrection after a violent protest stormed Capitol Hill as Congress was certifying the Electoral College's selection of Joe Biden. Polls still show that around 40% of voters think that Biden's victory was illegitimate. Public opinion was almost evenly split regarding Trump's responsibility in the Capitol Hill protests and along party lines. The Senate vote's outcome was never in doubt, as a two-thirds supermajority was needed for conviction. The trial was surprisingly rushed to completion.
Trump's big sin, from the point of view of the American ruling class, is that he brought the pitchforks to the castle. And that's what the ruling class is, and the entire apparatus of status quo politics in the United States is punishing Donald Trump for, and wants to make sure never happens again.
Democrats now have to contend with an exonerated Trump who can run for the presidency in 2024. Conservatives may be permanently divided into two factions, and polls show that a third party started by Trump would be even more popular than the Republican Party. The final fate of the controversial Trump seemed to overshadow what sparked the violent protest in the first place, yet the question remains, how can massive and violent disputes over electoral integrity be prevented?
A, have an electoral system that people have confidence in and can have confidence in, which we don't have. But even more, hey, we're giving you medical care. You have medical care. You rent is paid. You have a job. You have an income. You know, you don't have to worry about student debt. How many of those people are going to come to fight you over that?
Other questions remain, which are even more difficult to answer. Can a Trump-obsessed nation actually move on? Will Washington now focus on fixing the socioeconomic catastrophes caused by the coronavirus and lockdowns? How can this deeply divided nation heal? And when? And maybe, do they even want to? Given Trump's acquittal, many wonder if the impeachment trial ultimately did more harm than good. The Trump presidential era may be definitively over, finally, but the transition to get there was anything but peaceful. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Protesters hold a huge rally in Vienna's city center, defying a police ban on what's become regular rallies in Austria against the government-imposed restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Police put the official number of protesters at 2,000, but organizers said there were much more people, many of whom were forcefully barred from joining the bigger rallies.
Despite the police ban, thousands have been taking part in demonstrations like this over the past weeks. It looks like the arrests that have been made by the police during this time has done little to deter these crowds.
Many of the demonstrators said they were against the recently announced rule for older school children to take mandatory COVID tests and wear masks in school.
They have to test, they have to wear masks, they can't breathe and all this madness they have to do at school. And they have to stop now because they destroy actually our children. And the children, they are sick now in the brain because of all this madness going on here. And not because of the virus. They are sick because of the politicians.
Most of the protesters did not wear masks and were vocal in their dismissal.
There is no valid evaluation behind this. That the government can say this is the reason when we do not use it that we get sick, and this is absolutely nonsense.
Local media said protesters included high-profile members of far-right and neo-Nazi groups. Several people were arrested and at least two police officers were injured. The government's management of the COVID crisis has also been criticized by industrial groups who argue the restrictions are killing jobs, growth and wealth. For now, with infections still high, the government has decided to keep hotels and restaurants closed while reopening schools, shops and services. Homolezki, Vienna.
During a press conference in Caracas, UN Human Rights Envoy Alina Duhan spoke about her preliminary assessment of her visit to Venezuela to evaluate the effects of the U.S. blockade against the Latin American nation. The UN diplomat said that the ongoing humanitarian crisis hitting the Venezuelan people is a direct effect of the sanctions imposed by the United States. She remarked her visit was based on UN standards of independence, impartiality, and comprehensiveness. Duhan added that the unilateral measures implemented against Venezuela, its institutions, and assets abroad violate international law. She added that the sanctions implemented by Washington and its European allies also violate the rights of the country to respond to the needs of a people suffering from the consequences of the blockade. In this context, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza pondered the statement of the high-ranked UN official.
As the UN rapporteur said, the U.S. sanctions are illegal and harm our country. So Caracas relies on the UN and many nations to legally fight against such sanctions.
However, some opposition figures blamed the Maduro government for the sanctions.
The Maduro regime is being punished by the U.S. due to its refusal to hold free elections. So Maduro knows what to do to get the sanctions lifted.
But legal analysts say that U.S. sanctions cannot be justified by any means.
No country can meddle in the internal political affairs of another country. So U.S. sanctions are criminal and Venezuela will strongly resist against the aggression.
The UN official has described the effects of the illegal U.S. sanctions on Venezuela as devastating. Although Washington goes on imposing sanctions on the Latin American country, the UN diplomat urged the U.S. to stop its harmful measures. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
February 14, 2011 was the beginning of an uprising in Bahrain that brought tens of thousands of people to the streets across the tiny island to call for reform. But the peaceful movement soon turned bloody when the Al Khalifa dynasty began to quell demonstrations with an iron fist. backed by forces deployed from Saudi Arabia in the early months of the uprising and mercenaries from other countries, the Bahraini regime launched a brutal clampdown. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries, but those outcries failed to stop a kingdom that hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet.
The United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region, and so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power. So that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there.
Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party, Al-Wafaq, in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. It also revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people, including prominent cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. From the Iranian city of Qom, the 84-year-old spiritual leader marked the uprising anniversary via televised address.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands. And they have great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take.
He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al Khalifa regime. He noted that the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country. On the eve of the uprising anniversary, Bahrainis staged nationwide rallies, including in the capital Manama, and renewed their call for the downfall of King Hamad and his monarchy. The demonstrators also demanded that all political prisoners be freed. 10 years after the first wave of demonstrations rocked Bahrain, people are still hoping that their resistance would bring about democratic reforms, progress on human rights, as well as accountability for past and present abuses.
$2.3 million children under the age of 5 are estimated to be suffering from acute malnutrition, including 400,000 who could starve to death if they don't receive urgent treatment and humanitarian aid, according to 4 UN agencies.
We always hear that there are huge numbers regarding human suffering, but the problem is that we do not see any measures to address this issue. And there are great risks regarding children's health care. I think that the numbers are greater than those mentioned in the United Nations reports. We appeal to the donors to take measures that limit children's suffering mainly.
22% is the increased rate of acute malnutrition from last year's figures, which is the highest level recorded since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015. The UN agencies said a lack of funds was hampering humanitarian programs in Yemen, urging donor nations to commit to their obligations.
The United Nations has been talking about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen for 5 years, especially children, but it's only rhetoric. There is a clear reduction in the aid provided to children and women, so we believe that the United Nations aims through these statements to obtain more funding by the suffering of Yemenis.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the impoverished country some 6 years ago.
Despite the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the country, some believe that the UN agencies' reports are aimed at pushing more countries to donate and fulfill their programs rather than saving the lives of the Yemeni children. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There is plenty of evidence that the world's chocolate supply depends heavily on child labor, and that despite two decades of U.S. industry promises, it remains widespread. A Washington Post investigation of the use of child labor in the cocoa industry found representatives of some of the U.S.'s biggest and best-known brands could not guarantee that any of their chocolate was produced without child labor. It featured children from Burkina Faso and Mali working in appalling conditions on Ivory Coast cocoa farms. We're prepared for you an article written by Oliver Balch under the heading, High-Profile Chocolate Companies to Face Child Slavery Lawsuit in U.S. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Oliver Balch's article. Eight children who say they were used as slave labor on cocoa plantations in Ivory Coast have launched legal action against the world's biggest chocolate companies. They accuse the corporations of aiding and abetting the illegal enslavement of thousands of children on cocoa farms in their supply chains. Nestle, Cargill, Barry Callebaut, Mars, Olam, Hershey, and Mondelez have all been named as defendants in a lawsuit filed in Washington, D.C. by the human rights firm International Rights Advocates, IRA, on behalf of eight former child slaves who say they were forced to work without pay on cocoa plantations in the West African country. The plaintiffs, all of whom are originally from Mali and are now young adults, are seeking damages for forced labor and further compensation for unjust enrichment, negligent supervision, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. It is the first time that a class action lawsuit of this kind has been filed against the cocoa industry in a U.S. court of law. Citing research by the U.S. State Department, the International Labor Organization ILO, and UNICEF, among others, the court documents charge that the plaintiff's experience of child slavery is mirrored by that of thousands of other minors. Ivory Coast produces about 45% of the global supply of cocoa, a core ingredient in chocolate. The production of cocoa in West Africa has long been linked to human rights abuses, structural poverty, low pay, and child labor. A central charge of the lawsuit is that the defendants, despite not owning the cocoa farms in question, knowingly profited from the illegal work of children. According to the submissions, the defendants' contracted suppliers were able to provide lower prices than if they had employed adult workers with proper protective equipment. The class action lawsuit also charges the companies of actively misleading the public in their 2001 promise to phase out child labor. The original deadline for achieving the commitment, made as part of the voluntary Harkin-Engel Protocol, was 2005. The World Cocoa Foundation, an industry body to which all the defendants belong, now aims to achieve that target by 2025. In the complaint, all eight plaintiffs describe being recruited in Mali through trickery and deception, before being trafficked across the border to cocoa farms in the Ivory Coast. There, they were forced to work, often for several years or even more, with no pay, no travel documents, and no clear idea of where they were being held or how to get back to their families back in Mali. The court papers charge that the plaintiffs, all of whom were under 16 years of age at the time of their recruitment, worked on farms in major cocoa-producing areas of Ivory Coast. The defendants' apparent influence in these markets is described as dominant by the plaintiffs' counsel. The lawsuit says one plaintiff was only 11 years old when a local man in his hometown of Kurusandugu in Mali promised him work in Ivory Coast for 25,000 CFA francs or £34 a month. The legal documents say that the boy worked for 2 years without ever being paid, often applying pesticides and herbicides without protective clothing. The documents say another child, named as a plaintiff in the lawsuit, had visible cuts on his hands and arms from machete accidents. Speaking of his experience of forced labor between 2009 and 2011, he recalls being constantly bitten by insects. As with most of the plaintiffs, he charges in the lawsuit that he was promised payment after the harvest, but the payment never came. Many of the plaintiffs quoted in the court documents report being fed little and working long hours every day. Often they say they were kept alone or isolated from other child workers who spoke different dialects. During fieldwork for this case, the plaintiffs' legal team say that they routinely found children using machetes, applying chemicals and undertaking other hazardous tasks on cocoa plantations that were producing for one or more of the defendants. The court papers state, as well as being morally repugnant, such abuses against children represent a humanitarian disaster as they contribute to Ivory Coast's ongoing poverty. The court paper added, the widespread use of child slavery is also credited by the plaintiffs for causing long-term mental and physical trauma. The case documentation maintains that the defendants are responsible for developing the entire cocoa production system of Ivory Coast. As key participants in this venture, it is complained that they either knew or should have known about the systematic use of child labor in the plantations. The case is being brought under the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2017. International Rights Advocates, IRA, is currently involved in a separate complaint filed under the Alien Tort Statute against Nestle and Cargill. In a statement, Cargill claimed, "We are aware of the filing, and while we cannot comment on specifics of this case right now, the company wants to reinforce that we have no tolerance for child labor in cocoa production. Children belong in schools. They deserve safe living conditions and access to good nutrition." Nestle said that the lawsuit does not advance the shared goal of ending child labor in the cocoa industry and claimed, "Child labor is unacceptable and goes against everything we stand for. Nestlé has explicit policies against it and is unwavering in our dedication to ending it. We remain committed to combating child labor within the cocoa supply chain and addressing its root causes as part of the Nestlé Cocoa Plan and through collaborative efforts." Responding to news of the class action lawsuit, a Mars spokesperson said, "We don't comment on any possible pending litigation." Mondelez said it did not wish to comment. Barry Callebaut claimed it had committed to eradicating child labor from its supply chain by 2025. It said, "Every year we publish the progress we have made against this target in our Forever Chocolate Progress Report." An Olam spokesperson claimed that the company has a zero-tolerance policy for forced or slave labor in their supply chain. They said, "If we were to identify any instances, we would immediately take action, which includes notifying the appropriate authorities." Eshi have been approached for comment. However, there is plenty of evidence that the world's chocolate supply depends heavily on child labor, and that despite two decades of industry promises, it remains widespread. While much of it occurs on family farms, some is also arranged by traffickers who ferry in children from neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso. To human rights advocates, the persistence of child labor in the world's cocoa supply amounts to, at best, tragic negligence. A Washington Post investigation of the use of child labor in the cocoa industry found representatives of some of the United States' biggest and best-known brands could not guarantee that any of their chocolate was produced without child labor. It featured children from Burkina Faso and Mali working in appalling conditions on cocoa farms in the Ivory Coast.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The first International New Horizon Conference was held in 2012 and focused on having a creative hub where academics, artists, politicians, activists, and others could cooperate on discussing various global topics and searching for a solution, from the issue of Palestine to Hollywood to the situation of Black Americans in the United States. The conference held vibrant discussions and served as an effective forum to have these discussions. Well, the conference host is filmmaker and Iranian TV personality Nader Talibzadeh. In 2019, the New Horizon Conference, Mr. Talibzadeh and others who had organized the conference were sanctioned by the United States. Even the FBI approached some of the American participants and warned them of dire consequences if they attended the event. I will be talking to some of the speakers from the conference on this debate. Stay with us, please. I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, author and former diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C., editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. Thank you all for being with us and welcome to the program. Well, let's start it off with Michael. Michael, in your perspective, what were the overall goals of the New Horizon Conference, because, of course, it's been accused of a range of things by the FBI, by the Department of Treasury in the United States. Your experience, in your perspective, with what you saw and experienced, what do you think the overall goals were?
Well, the goals, specifically at the conference I was at to talk about Palestine, however, I think the principal goal was to bring together a group of people from all over the world with different backgrounds and different skills and abilities to meet and talk together and try and come to an understanding and produce a common program for change. When I was at the conference, I sat next to an Arab journalist and a woman who had been to the first Gaza relief expedition, the only one that the Zionists didn't attack. There were people there who had formerly been with the Central Intelligence Agency. There were Hungarian politicians, Serbian journalists. It was a group of people from, including German politicians, along with a rabbi, David Weiss from New York City, and Niko Peled, an Israeli-American. It was a tremendously disparate group of people who shared a common goal in trying to make the world better. And, of course, Sigal Pearl Mandukar, the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, put a stop to that by sanctioning the conference, the management, and threatening all sorts of horrible actions to anyone who dared to go into any other conference organized by the New Horizon people.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get to that part.
In my
part.
View, it was the grandest adventure of my life.
Stay with me, Michael. I'm going to get to that part in the second question, but I want to get each of my guests as a perspective on their experiences at the conference. Kevin, your take, what did you find? What did you experience at the New Horizon Conference that you participated in?
Well, it was almost like a kind of international summit for alternative media and alternative intellectuals, people who, for one reason or another, have been blacklisted in the West and who are looking into the issues that are completely taboo in Western media and the academy. And, of course, these are in many ways the most important issues. So it was really like going to a kind of a summit with a lot of the people that I admired and hadn't gotten to know in person before. I'd only known them through the Internet, and then getting to actually meet them was fantastic. And I think it's interesting that some of the most important and groundbreaking thinkers in the West have to go to Tehran to meet. That's why we had Dr. E. Michael Jones calling Tehran the capital of the free world, because the so-called free world is not so free these days. And, you know, features, we're not talking about people from a particular ideological tendency. We've had everybody from the pretty far left mainstream, like Senator Mike Gravel, one of the great heroes of the anti-Vietnam War movement, one of the heroes of the Democratic Party, who's later in the Libertarian and Green parties. And then we've also had people on the right, like Dr. Jones, among many others. So it was very well balanced in terms of different worldviews and perspectives, and yet everyone there is facing certain issues truthfully, and these are the issues that you're just not going to face truthfully in the United States of hypocrisy and in the equally hypocritical states of Europe these days. So it's here in the United States, it feels rather ironic that in this land of freedom with the First Amendment, we have to go to Tehran to engage in free speech.
Okay, stay with me. What about that, Anthony? You heard what Kevin said, and we've heard this before. Because I also was at a couple of the conferences, and I heard people actually say that they felt so free and being able to discuss issues that perhaps they could not have discussed in the United States. Your take and your experience.
Yes, of course, I did not appreciate how I'm getting feedback in my earphones. I didn't appreciate how closed, how constrained the discussion was in North American academic circles until I went in 2014 to the New Horizon Conference in Tehran and heard one was very, interested to meet people from Iran and hear new perspectives in that respect, but also to meet Europeans from many parts of Europe, North Americans, basically people who use the English language in dissident positions in their own home turf. And so I was introduced and stretched, and my capacities were stretched to try to move along with the discussion and open myself up. Then after the meeting, what was surprising to me was the Anti-Defamation League, Abe Foxman, to hear these condemnations, these blanket condemnations of everybody at the conference as Holocaust deniers, as conspiracy theorists, as 9/11 truthers, all these weaponized terms used on steroids in a way. I was introduced to the kind of, I guess, big leagues of the polemics at the global level.
Well, going back to you, Michael, I mean, why would the United States have a problem with a forum that most people would say was quite dynamic and is quite dynamic, and allowing political perspectives across the gamut for people to sit down and discuss and talking about various problems and trying to come up with solutions and solidarity across the world? Why would this be problematic for Washington?
Well, it's problematic because Washington is controlled by the Zionists. Jews form 2% of the American population, yet they are controlling most of the foreign policy agencies in the Biden administration now. They are desperately afraid of free speech, more and more in the United States, aside from the Zionist people. They don't want anything that contradicts the official line of American policy, whether you're dealing with the virus, whether you're dealing with September 11th, or whether you're dealing with the basics of American foreign policy. And in Iran, in Tehran, it was a freewheeling, open discussion of people with disparate backgrounds, disparate viewpoints, who yet got along, who respected each other. And this is something the United States doesn't want, because Iran, to it and its supporters in the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel, is that Iran is a dangerous, malign influence in the region and is building atomic bombs under every bed in the country, and they're going to use them all against Israel. So the whole idea of the United States objecting to any kind of freewheeling discussion in Iran is anathema, because it shows that Iran is a democratic country that permits opposing viewpoints, whatever that they might be.
Kevin, your perspective, when you look at as far as the slogans that we hear all the time in the United States, and also, as Michael said, what is said about Iran, there's a 180-degree difference, it seems, from the reality. So people from the West were invited to the Islamic Republic of Iran to hold these dynamic discussions, but then the United States couldn't handle that. Do you think that this is a sign of a waning empire, that even it fears open discussions in an international forum?
Yes, I think the current crackdown on free speech, which has gone further and further in so many ways, and the ridiculous attack on New Horizon under false pretenses, is one aspect of this war on free speech, which is really a war against the founding principles of the American Republic, because there wouldn't have been any American Republic and American Constitution if the critics of the original version of the Constitution hadn't been able to get the Bill of Rights added. And the First Amendment is the heart of the Bill of Rights, and in many ways the heart of the Constitution. And the U.S. is not an ethnic state. It doesn't have a deep history. It's not one people going back for millennia. It's a group of people from all over the world who are living together according to these Enlightenment principles, and free speech to free inquiry are right at the door. But today we're seeing that roll back in so many different ways. And I think that with the issue of who was trying to shut down New Horizon, it wasn't so much the realist American imperialist people. Remember, this was during the Obama administration. which followed the Bush-Cheney years with 9/11 and the so-called War on Terror, the Declaration Against the Axis of Evil, and so on. And then Obama was supposed to change that, and he did to some extent bring in a slightly different group of people who had less problem, really, with New Horizon than the neocons do. And so it wasn't the Obama administration that was trying to stop us from going to Iran. On the contrary, I actually was treated quite respectfully every time I went. I had only one interrogation on the way back from Iran after going to New Horizon conferences almost every year from 2013 on. And that interrogation was just a minute and a half friendly conversation, really. So I think things really came to a head there sort of towards the end of the Obama administration, and then with the Trump administration, as the neocons turned things around. And their main concern is the state of Israel and the power of the Zionist lobby in the world and in the West. And I think they're terrified that American intellectuals will see eye to eye with Canadians like Dr. Hall, with Europeans, and with Russians, and with Iranians especially, and recognize that U.S. policy in the Middle East is not benefiting the U.S. at all. It's actually shooting the U.S. in the foot. We've wasted $7 trillion on these post-9/11 wars for Israel. So the pound, free speech around New Horizon, as Mike Springman says, were basically Israel people, lobbyists and so on, the Anti-Defamation League. And then when the Obama administration gave way to the Trump administration and the Zionists or neocon Zionists came back into power, they're totally banned Americans from going to any New Horizon conferences under penalty of going to prison when you come back from Lebanon or Iran or what have you. This is really about protecting Israel and protecting Israel's power over the United States. Mm-hmm. And if ordinary Americans could see that this war on America and the war on America's First Amendment is being waged on behalf of an extremely hostile foreign interest entity, the State of Israel, that has repeatedly attacked the U.S. in false flag terrorism, from Operation Susanna in the 50s to the Liberty Incident in 1967 to the controlled demolition of the Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Americans essentially declare war on Israel, and the issue, the elephant in the room, it was the Zionists who had to try to put a stop to Americans and Iranians having dialogue and trying to figure out what's really going on.
Okay. Well, Anthony, your take. You heard what Kevin said. I want to look at that because with what happened to New Horizon Conference and the organizers of the New Horizon Conference basically being sanctioned, trying to the United States to shut them down, perhaps an average American, if they heard this story, didn't feel that it affected them. But as the old saying goes, and then they came for me, because if we fast forward now to 2021 in the United States, and we see how censorship continues to get worse and worse inside of the country, how alternative perspectives and even which some perspectives which was once considered mainstream are being shut down and controlled. I want your perspective about that, because perhaps many Americans did not speak out for the sanctions against Iran in general and against, for example, like a New Horizon conference. Has that backfired now?
Well, we could see a sign of trouble on the horizon in 2019 at Beirut when I attended the New Horizon conference, the last one. Kevin and Michael Springman couldn't go to that one. The U.S. people were kept out. And then came the year 2020, a year of enormous divisiveness in the United States between the people who supported Trump, the so-called deplorables, and the Biden group, which had a tremendous alliance of power behind it. But even at the height of all of this crisis in 2020, the one thing that both sides seemed to be able to agree upon was that Iran is the biggest enemy, and the propaganda and pressure kept coming from Israel to these wars for Israel. The sort of penultimate one would be the invasion of Iran, which has been pushed for and pushed for and pushed for. And I think even now, with all that's happened, Americans have a hard time to see that the invisibility of this Israel lobby, and it is kept behind walls and barriers and censorship, this unity to support Israel and point towards this sort of ultimate goal of invading and doing regime change in Iran. This is so consistent, and we have very little testimony on mainstream media about this. And it is the most destabilizing force in the world, really.
Well, Michael, you just heard Anthony talk about Americans not being able to attend the conference in Beirut. What does that mean? Explain to our audience, as an American, when you're told that you're not allowed to travel somewhere and participate in the conference, tell us what happened.
Well, I frankly was outraged at this. The whole issue of sanctions is being run by a Zionist-controlled Office of Foreign Assets Control that goes back to 1950 and Harry Truman and China and the Korean War. The issue, of course, is it limited my freedom to travel. It's a basic constitutional right that the Supreme Court has held any number of decisions about and stating in unequivocally that Americans are free to travel wherever they want. Yet the executive branch of the government forbids travel to Cuba, it forbids travel to Venezuela, it forbids travel to Iran except under special circumstances. And of course, if you are going to attend a conference that's being promoted by a group that's been sanctioned by the Treasury Department, you are subject to astonishing fines and prison term. And the conference sounded very interesting. I knew people who were going. They were who I knew by reputation and would love to have met in person. And since I went to the one 3 years ago now, I would have loved to have gone back and met a number of people that I might have not met before, or new people that I could make acquaintance with and renew old relationships. So it's it personally harmed me, and I think it harmed the everyone's view of the United States. That only non-Americans might be able to go to a conference that supposedly is based on free exchange and fair exchange of ideas and viewpoints, and that the people involved are able to speak their minds no matter what they say, where they say it, or where they're from. It goes against everything the United States stands for and was ever built upon and ever hopes to be.
Kevin, can you tell our viewers exactly what happened? Did you have a visit from the FBI? OFAC gave you information. Tell us how the information was transferred to you that you should not travel or participate in the conference that was going to be held in Lebanon.
Well, first I heard from some friends of mine, Sandra Hicks and indeed Mike Springman were among them, who had actually had visits or contacts from the FBI about this. And then my phone rang shortly thereafter. And it was the local FBI guy from Madison, Wisconsin. And he wanted to try to set up an interview with me. And he said it was about New Horizon. And there, we had a brief conversation. And I admitted to him, yes, I understand that you're telling me I can't go to the New Horizon conference or I'll be arrested on the way back. And he agreed with that. So that was, he confirmed that information, which I'd already heard from other people who'd actually had the FBI at their doorsteps early in the morning. But in my case, it was fortunately just this phone call. And so I said, yes, I'll sit down and talk with you about this because I have no secrets. I think everybody needs to hear about this, but I need to record it because I don't want to be misrepresented. And so he checked with the superior and they said, no, the FBI will not allow you to record the conversation with the FBI.
I think we're having some technical problems there with Kevin. What about you, Anthony? I mean, you're Canadian, so were you not told not to attend the conference? Did you have any problems? Because I understand that you did go to Lebanon. Did you have any problems when you returned?
No, I didn't. I never have. I've always just come straight back into Canada, and I've never been interrogated in any way on what happens to me on the trip.
Let's talk about the conference in Lebanon that the United States was so afraid of, Anthony. Tell us about the conference. What was taking place there that Washington feared so much?
Well, it was quite something to be having a New Horizon conference on the shores of the Mediterranean. And I think the reality is that since 2014, when I went to my first New Horizon conference, and 2019, the influence of Iran has expanded westward. And, you know, Iran has been exercising a certain amount of widened influence. And so obviously that seemed to be frightening the United States, the fact that this was taking, the U.S. government, the fact that this was taking place in Lebanon. And it was fascinating for me to go up to the border of Israel, for instance, at the Iranian park on the border of Israel and Lebanon. I wasn't aware of such a thing. It was fascinating to get to know Hezbollah, to meet people in it, and find that, you know, it's every sort of grandmother and child, and, you know, it's the entire society in the south of Lebanon might be considered Hezbollah. It was eye-opening in many ways. And what was also eye-opening was the fact that the U.S. government has become so petrified of allowing discourse and free exchange of ideas in the type of milieu that we've developed and cultivated at New Horizon, that the U.S. Was showing itself and taking such a repressive act, which of course is now becoming commonplace as the Biden group prepared to define all the basic Trump supporters, I guess you could say the deplorables, as domestic terrorists. So much of this injustice and prevention of due process, free speech, and innocent until proven guilty goes forward in the name of terrorism. Now it seems that the U.S. has become so conversant with using this technique to repress people that it's about to do it on its own citizens, on a huge swath of its own citizens.
And hopefully you guys will continue to be somewhat free to talk about the reality here in Iran. I appreciate all of you being with me for this program looking at the New Horizon Conference. Author and former diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall, out of Lethbridge.